The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Avery Schmitz with an episode of Chatter for April 16th, 2023. For today's episode, the Lawfare team decided to cross-post this week's episode of Chatter, a podcast from David Priest and Shane Harris, featuring in-depth discussions with fascinating people at the creative edges of national security. Today's Chatter episode is entitled, Reporting from the Front Lines with Nancy Youssef. In the episode, Harris sat down with Youssef to discuss her career reporting on national security issues, the recent detention of Youssef's Wall Street Journal colleague, Evan Gershkovich, and the risks journalists face from violent actors and authoritarian governments worldwide. This is Chatter.
This is Chatter. I'm Shane Harris. This week, journalist Nancy Youssef on reporting from the front lines.
You know, you'd go in every time and sort of ask yourself, am I going to come out with 10 fingers and 10 toes? Like, you knew you might not make it. Look, when I started in 2003, if you said journalists, it was like waving a white flag. And now we see states that really treat information, the distribution of information, as warfare. You know, there have been 26 hostages who have been released during the Biden administration. 26 in 26 months, basically. How many do we know about? We know about a few of them. I just wonder what happened with those other, 20 cases that we're not as familiar with, but there was a solution.
Nancy Youssef, welcome to Chatter.
I'm so happy to be here.
I'm so happy to be here too. Sadly, we are not together.
We're both in undisclosed locations.
On assignment for America. How are you? It's good to see you.
I'm so happy to see you.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a before March 29th and after March 29th. You know, it's honestly, like, I was out to dinner last night and the service wasn't very good. And I thought, what am I complaining about? Do you understand what your colleague's going through?
Yeah.
So I'm filled with profound gratitude that we're okay. And a lot of focus on Evan.
Yeah. And for those who will soon know about this story, Nancy, of course, is talking about Evan Gershkovich, her Wall Street Journal colleague. I think we all think of Evan, even those who don't know him, as part of our whole journalistic tribe. Journalists are very much a tribe of people. And so even if you don't work with somebody at the same paper, you think of them as your colleague. But Evan has now been, since Nancy said, in late March, in prison in Russia, where he has been doing really tremendous reporting for quite a while at the Moscow Times. He was doing stuff also for the Journal, obviously, doing a lot of very compelling reporting during the pandemic in Russia, and has been arrested and accused of being a spy, which he and his employer and the United States government vociferously deny. And we'll get into Evan's case, and there's actually been some really interesting developments in that case, which you all at the Journal have reported on. But really what I brought you here to talk about was, the risks that journalists face when they are reporting from dangerous areas. And you have a lot of experience with that, reporting from conflict zones, reporting from war zones. You have colleagues who've been in situations like Evan's before. You have colleagues who We still don't have home yet. I'm thinking of Austin Tice as being a big one. So I thought it'd be great for us to talk so maybe readers or listeners can get a better appreciation of what it's really like for reporters to work in these situations. And I want to talk about you. So before we get all into that, we're going to talk about Nancy. Nancy and I have worked together before at the Daily Beast. We are dear friends. I love her. She's one of the best out there in the business. We have great fun together. So tell me about young Nancy. Where does it all begin? Tell us where you grew up and tell us what you remember about being young and being interested in journalism. Like, when did you first start thinking about the news?
So I'm the daughter of two Egyptian immigrants who came here in the 1970s. My dad came here with $220, ended up in Washington taking government work because I was born out just outside of New York City. And my dad had faced a lot of racial discrimination, and he was so scared that he would be fired for being North African, for being Arab, that he decided to move to Washington, take government work, hoping that it would lead to more job stability. So that's kind of how we ended up here. And so if you grew up in D.C., there is no real local news because it's so subsumed by national and international news. And so newspapers were one of the very few Western things that were sort of allowed in our house. I remember my dad having a Washington Post and an Arabic English dictionary and using the Washington Post to learn and improve his English. And so I think if there was an attachment to journalism, it started there. And I think when you're an immigrant's child, you already sort of feel like a constant observer because you're not quite American. You're not quite Egyptian. You're kind of always feeling like the outside. And isn't that what journalism is? We're professional observers. And so I don't even know if I chose to be a journalist so much as my life led me that way.
Yeah.
So all those reasons, I think, made me want to be a journalist from middle school. And I started working at papers then, you know, school papers.
Yeah.
And then...
Did you have like a beat at the school paper?
Yes. I've had faculty as a beat. Ooh. I've had general news. I've had administration. I got all the geeky beats, like none of the fun ones.
You were just pissing off people in power since the beginning.
Oh my gosh, from the very beginning. Honestly. And then... But like speaking Arabic and being a Muslim American and being from this region was like weird. And then 9/11 happened. And all of a sudden, all these things that I'd been exposed to were essential to understanding the things happening around us. So then I went to Iraq and I'd never done any national reporting. I went from the Detroit Free Press. And I'd only went to the Detroit Free Press because it was right after 9/11. I thought, who's going to appreciate an Arabic speaker? Detroit will. And I just called them, cold called them, said, hire me. And they did.
I didn't know you cold called them. And that's how you got the job.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
They were probably couldn't believe their luck. They're like, oh my God, she's a reporter and she speaks this language that we desperately need skill in. Yeah.
Literally packed my car. Don't you remember those days when you could fit everything in the car and drove the 9 hours up? And it was the best experience. I love Detroit and I love Detroiters. So then I had nothing. I just went from there. And are we allowed to curse on this podcast?
Okay, hell great. Yeah.
the Detroit Free Press, many, many newspaper sales ago, was a Knight Ridder paper. And they literally just put out an email that said, who wants to go cover the war? And this will sound adorable to some of your younger listeners. They thought the war would be a few months. So it was like, you could be a war reporter for a few months. And my editor, who ended up being my editor for the next 12 years, he called me and he said, do you have any national reporting experience? And I said, no. Do you have any international reporting experience? No. And these are all quotes, by the way. Can you do anything? And I said, well, I speak Arabic. And he said, fine, we'll send you to Jordan. If you don't fuck up, we'll go from there. Click. And that was the start of my journalism career in the Middle East. Okay.
Amazing.
So now I'm in Iraq and I'm in my 20s and you're watching war and it's and there's no preparation for it. And we're just going into central Baghdad. And that's it. And, you know, people think the war in Iraq was sort of lost over a period of months. It wasn't. It was a matter of days. Mm. It was. And this is where the Arabic was so helpful because you saw like a bunch of soldiers and Marines told guard the space. And an Iraqi man who had the expectation that a bunch of Arnold Schwarzenegger looking people were going to come in, liberate their country, then give them the sheet of paper for what ministry they report to and leave being the most important part of that sentence.
Yeah.
And instead they go up to the Arnold Schwarzenegger looking guy and they say, dear sir, in Arabic, where do I go for my job? And the guy holds the gun up and says, get back. Dear sir, get the fuck back, because his only job is to guard that space. So you just saw these series of misunderstandings happening within the first few days. I wrote, the war ended April 9th. I wrote a story April 20th that said this wasn't going well, because you could just feel it. And so I did that for 4 years, and then came to the Pentagon because I knew war anecdotally, but I'd never studied it. I was watching all these decisions, the impact, but I didn't understand how they were being made. And so I did that, and then Arab Spring happened. I went back to the Middle East, and once that was clearly not going to go the way I think some had hoped in 2014, I came back, and this is my second rotation. And that's the short version of how it happened. So it was all, I never really intended it, but I'm glad it's worked out that way. And what I basically covered is war front lines that, I think we think of war front lines as sort of huge masses of troops. But what I've been covering are conflicts that are born between people inside the Humvee and the people outside the Humvee. Mm-hmm. That's the front line, that Humvee going through a street.
Yeah.
And that's been my job, is understanding what it's like to be in the Humvee. And I know that as an American, having been in it, and you don't know who's a threat. And I also know it outside, when you're looking at people who are treating you like an Iraqi, like an Egyptian, like a Libyan, like whomever, and thinking of you as a threat.
It makes me think of how you talked about being in your home growing up, where you feel like, I'm sort of not American, I'm sort of not Egyptian, I'm kind of floating in this, like, you're sort of like perennially spending your life going down between those two paths. What was it like? Because I know in covering the military, one thing that you have is both, I've always thought, is a lot of appreciation and sympathy and empathy for the troops, and also just like often a lot of appropriate skepticism for their commanders and Pentagon officials, holding them to accountable, which is exactly what we're supposed to do. What did you learn about, like, these kids who were there, right? I mean, did they think the war would be over quickly? Were they scared? Were they excited? I mean, what was your impressions of watching these young people, I presume some of whom, you know, were younger than you were, thrust into this war that, of course, we all thought was going to just kind of go like the first Gulf War, done and dusted, and we're finished.
A lot of them had never left their country before. Mm-hmm. And then they were in this situation and were handed tremendous responsibilities, and many rose to the occasion. I think over time, what you found is they weren't fighting the broader war as defined by people in Washington or in wearing stars on their shoulders. They were fighting for their brother, for the guy next to them. And you were watching in real time the sort of scars of war sort of landing on them, right? Mm-hmm. You'd go out on embed, and you know, the Humvee would come back, and an EFP had gone through, and there was just mist left of somebody inside, you know? Mm. You were watching these scars and asking yourself, what is the long-term impact? And that's what I think about with them, that they weren't fighting the bigger cause. They were fighting for one another, mm-hmm. for their own survival. Mm-hmm. And that people went in with the best of intentions, but didn't fully understand what was happening around them or what mm-hmm. was being asked of them. And it was those misunderstandings over and over again. So it was hard to be mad at them, because this is the circumstance they found themselves in.
Sure.
It was hard to be forgiving as well, because you're watching the impact on Iraqis every day.
Yeah. What about, how did you feel going in there as a reporter? You'd never covered a war or a conflict zone, right, by that point. So what's going through your mind when you get there about your personal safety? I mean, are you scared? Are you thinking about that? Or do you just kind of throw yourself into the job and put that other stuff you stow away in the backseat?
You know, you'd go in every time and sort of ask yourself, am I going to come out with 10 fingers and 10 toes?
Yeah.
Like, you knew you might not make it. And the beauty of youth is you don't know what it means. Like, I would think, well, if I don't make it, I've had a good life. You know, 25.
25 years are pretty good.
Because you don't, this is the cruelty of surviving it. And when others don't, you realize that over time how much they're missing.
Right.
But at the time, you don't understand. But security was a huge part of it. I was always trying to sort of stay in the middle. And that by that, I mean, I didn't want to be the most cautious person. And I didn't want to be the most reckless person. I wanted, frankly speaking, someone to be a more attractive target to me on either side of me. And that's what I was trying to walk the entire time. And the other thing you have to do is find whatever is comfortable for you. mm-hmm. and to not judge anybody whose comfort zone is different than yours.
Okay.
We had people who came to Iraq and would not leave the bureau, would not leave the hotel. That's as far as they could go. That's as far as they could go. And you had to respect that. Because if you ask somebody to go outside of that, they're endangering you, they're endangering everybody else around you.
Right.
And then you have to think creatively within those confines. So how do you report when you're scared to leave? How do you report when you don't know if things are changing? You're constantly trying to figure out ways. How do I feel the pulse of the city? How do I? So like I would do silly things. Like I would go get my hair done, not to get my hair done, but to listen and not say anything. Just listen to the other women chattering. How much of it was complaining about their war? How much of it was about their husbands? I do that at grocery stores, mm-hmm. constantly looking for ways that worked within my own level of comfort. But allowed me to get a pulse of where things were.
Right.
And then, you know, you have a staff. I mean, it was a staff of 21 people. I never managed anyone and now manage them in a war zone. You're trying to create a camaraderie.
Right.
You're trying to, among different sects at a time when there's nothing but sectarian violence around you.
And a lot of local people who came to work for the bureau, probably
21
too.
Of them.
Yeah. And that was all, 'cause it was all local. Okay. Yeah.
It was all local.
It was all local.
And so you're trying to create loyalty. It's a war zone. You're trying to create an incentive for them to be invested in the coverage.
Right.
So it was all those things. So it was a really challenging time for sure, but it is the foundation of everything I do now.
Yeah. How did preparation for reporters then, and by preparation, I mean what your employer would do to kind of train you for going into a dangerous area, compare then to the systems that we have now before we newspapers, news organizations send people into places like, you know, Afghanistan, when we still probably have more active reporting there, or Ukraine now. How did it compare then, and what's the system more like today?
So in both cases, they have you kind of go through this week-long training where you're taken hostage and
pretend hostage, to be clear.
Yeah, they put a mask on you so you understand what it is to have that happen to you, and first aid training and all this. And they do that. They did that then, and they do that now. I think the difference is that time has sort of taught people what they need to consider. I think there was an assumption that if you had a security person, that would be enough. And the truth is, it is not enough in either case. You have to have somebody on the ground who's feeling the pulse of the city. So, I think we realized over time that you can't just depend on a security person, mm-hmm. that the decisions about where to go, where not to go, really require a keen understanding of language and culture, of sourcing, of, you know, not doing things like going somewhere and then coming back 2 days and saying you're going to be back in 2 days, because that makes you vulnerable for kidnapping, or not going out to a scene right away because there could be a secondary bomb.
Mm-hmm.
So I think those things are consistent. I think the other big change is when I was in Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya and Egypt, the biggest threat were non-state actors. It was ISIS. It was Al-Qaeda. Now when you're reporting, the biggest threat are state actors.
Mm-hmm.
The states taking over. IEDs or rockets being launched by states.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been a huge evolution in terms of how we think about security, because you're not working with a terror group to secure a release of your colleague. You're working with a state,
mm-hmm.
or you're depending on state relations and diplomacy. So I think those are the big changes that I think we've learned over time, that it's not so easy as to sort of put on a spreadsheet. Here are the threat assessments. This means we can and can't go. That is a bit more nuanced than that. And that the threats are not from terror groups the way they were just 5 years ago,
right.
but for keeping people safe while in states that are authoritarian, and that view journalism and information as important to warfare as weapons and tanks.
Yeah, and that's actually a very good segue into talking about Evan Gershkovich, who, just for a little bit of background, we kind of talked about this at the beginning, but, you know, Evan had been living in and reporting in Russia for a number of years. His parents are both Russian. They had emigrated to the United States. It's actually not that dissimilar from the story that you were telling about your own family. He grew up speaking Russian, felt a lot of affinity for Russia, and felt that it was kind of, you know, there's been profiles written about him lately where he talked about it like a home that he felt he was in danger of losing touch with. So I think it clearly Russia held a lot of allure to him on a personal level, in addition to being a very interesting journalistic story. So maybe just like set the scene for us a little bit. How you work in the Washington bureau of the paper. You've bylined stories with Evan before from when he was in Russia. Give us a little sense of what your understanding was as just a member of the paper and on staff. Like, what was Evan doing and in Russia, kind of what was the role he was able to fill for the paper? Because listeners may not know this. A lot of news organizations do not have many, and in some cases, any reporters in Russia, precisely because they were afraid of what happened to Evan. So give us a little sense of, like, prior to March 29th, where he fits into the Wall Street Journal daily basis.
So we've had extraordinary coverage from our European colleagues. We've had reporters based in Ukraine, in Poland, across Eastern Europe, and in Moscow. And these were reporters who were accredited by the Russian government, so they were there legally. And they were operating as journalists, and there had been no question Evan had been reporting for years. And he just brought an extraordinary eye and voice to what was happening in Russia at the time of this war. And so he wrote really thoughtful pieces about how the pandemic was affecting Russia, how the sanctions were affecting Russia. He gave voice to the Russian experience at this war. And I think the objective was that so often we sort of oversimplify, we call U.S. adversaries, they're the Russians, and sort of put this blank statement on them in terms of who they are and what they represent. And he was saying, these are individuals, these are people, these are families, these are communities that deserve voice. And so I really enjoyed his reporting because I just thought he gave a voice to the a perspective that was necessary to properly and fully understand the conflict. And
very humanizing. And
he really did. And I loved his enthusiasm. It was his first year at the Journal, and now I'm showing my age. You love seeing a reporter who's just ready to try and be creative and look for new ways to report. And I just, on a personal level, I appreciated that.
Yes. He is still a young reporter. We should remember that.
I know now, Shane, 31. That's young to us.
Okay. Well, youngish.
Thank you.
Okay. But his first, like going from where he had been to being writing for smaller publications to getting a job as a Russia correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, that is a big deal. Like, that is like you've made it to the major leagues now.
It's a huge deal. And he honored that. He honored that. He wanted to do great work and do it in a responsible way. And so there was so much talk around security. What I saw was a paper really committed to keeping its journalists safe first and foremost. And at the same time, report the most consequential news story of our time as thoroughly as possible. And so I wasn't part of the discussions around security, but it was always sort of, you could hear it. And it was the constant part of the conversation. Mm-hmm. So you might hear a correspondent has left because we think this would be smart. You might hear, we're not going to pursue the story because we think it might be risky. I never saw anyone reckless. I saw in Evan someone with a lot of enthusiasm who had something to say in a way that most didn't, and was there to do it legally and responsibly. And I admired him.
Do you know, maybe you don't know, but did he ever express any worry or concern that, you know, he knew the risk that he could get scooped up or arrested? Or was there ever any just talk about that among colleagues? Or again, is that something that you know can happen, but you've made a decision to be there, do the job, and so you just do the job?
I don't know what those discussions were. I know that he had been followed by the Russian authorities in the course of his time in Russia. I don't know how often that is. My sense is that that was something that happened to journalists. That's the extent of what I know. I know that there was conversations around safety, but I don't know the specifics.
Yeah. Yeah. I think something that, you know, is helpful for listeners to understand too, is that, you know, when the war began, no one was really sure, kind of like in the Iraq experience, how long the war would last. And there was this expectation, I think, in the Pentagon and other quarters too, that the Russians would go in, they would, you know, knock out the Zelensky government, they'd put a government of their choosing in charge, and that kind of things would proceed from there. And I don't know that anybody anticipated that the war would keep going and that the threat to reporters in Russia would become as acute, you know, as it did. And I remember when we started, you know, more or less pulling people back, and you could see other, you know, in throughout the coverage, reporters that looked like they were probably in Russia, but they weren't datelining anything in Russia or items coming out of Russia, like without bylines on them. In other words, like not having the name of the reporter who wrote it. And it just seemed to me that there was this kind of dawning sense that, like, oh God, this is becoming really treacherous now in a way that maybe we had not expected that it would be before the war. And in a weird way, reporting in Russia seemed to me to be even more dangerous in some ways than reporting in Ukraine, which is not to say that in Ukraine you couldn't get injured or even killed, but you kind of know the risk that you're taking on the battlefield, and you can avoid certain places. You can go into the air raid shelter when the sirens are sounding. You can choose to go to the front line or not go. But in Russia, and you talked about like the threat being the state, right? It's suddenly everything is around you. You could be arrested at any time. You could be eating in a cafe the way Evan was, and they come and they scoop you up and throw you in a van. And that just seems to me an entirely different kind of threat, and one that, you know, is to me even more menacing, frankly.
Sure. I mean, look, when I started in 2003, if you said journalists, it was like waving a white flag and you were not to be touched. And obviously that evolved as we became negotiation tactics or ways to get ransom for terror groups. And now we see states that really treat information as warfare, as part of warfare, the distribution of information. And we've seen this in China, in Iran, in Egypt, where journalists are facing threats. It's funny when you speak about that, you know what I've been thinking the whole time is those local journalists in those countries, the risk that they're taking. You know, one thing in Iraq that always stood out to me that made me not allow myself to feel any real pity is I knew that anytime I could leave, it was not my country that was in the middle of war. I could leave. As hard as I was fighting, I had the option of leaving. And to me, I'm struck by the journalists who are in these countries who continue to report, because the bravery that you see from them is extraordinary. Some have been kicked out of their home country. Some have been arrested. And so when I think about sort of what it means to be working in these environments, I'm so struck by, and maybe this is the bias of having lived in Iraq, the local journalists who are doing it in their home countries, where the threat is so imminent. So that's what I always think about when I think about that threat. I think there'd been some assumption, there has been an assumption in the past that states would honor the agreements, that if people follow the law, like if you're an accredited journalist, then you're recognized as a journalist. So how do you have the imagination to think at any point you could be called something that you are not? Mm-hmm. You are not. I don't know. I mean, the last time I think I faced that in any way, and it's not anywhere near in comparison, is Egypt, where you, in real time, we were seeing Egypt go from a state where you could have elections and have open press and say things that you could never have said before, to seeing that slowly shut down. And now it's very hard for journalists, independent journalists, to operate in Egypt. So to your point, I think these things happen. You see them happening in front of you. You see the sort of the aperture closing in terms of what you can say or what you can't say. And the challenge is, how do you respond? Are you responding fast enough in the appropriate way? And at the same time, honor your commitment to the reader to let them know what's happening, because it's so important.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called Hleck. I have no idea what Hleck is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20.
And you guys have been doing, the journal where I worked for a year too, has been doing amazing work, keeping other journalists informed about what's going on with Evan's case, doing great coverage of him. You guys just had a story that I think Vivian Salama did, that the State Department has now designated Evan as wrongfully detained, which is important because it's them officially saying he's not a spy the way you're accusing him. And now his case is going to be managed by a part of the State Department that can actually negotiate. And I think everyone assumes that the reason the Russians are arresting him and calling him a spy is because they want to then trade him you know, for somebody in our country who might be a convicted spy or somebody high profile, the way that we ended up trading Victor Boot for Brittany Griner. And so Evan has kind of become a pawn in this. So you've seen these kinds of things play out. I mean, we talked about how, you know, you're very familiar with Austin Tice's case, a bit different in that Austin, nobody ever announced we're holding him and trying to negotiate for him. Austin has just been kind of missing for many years. But give people a sense of, like, this, based on your experience and just following Evan's case, like, what happens to him now? Like, what can we sort of anticipate is going to be the process by which presumably he eventually gets out, but not until the Russians have obtained something that they want in exchange?
Yeah, I mean, the big difference, and you're right to point it out, between Austin and Evan's case is we don't know where Austin is. We know where Evan is. And so in terms of the U.S. effort, for cases like Austin, so much of the focus is just finding where he is.
Yeah, and he was reporting in Syria at the time.
That's right. I'm sorry if I didn't say that earlier.
No, I didn't say it either.
But with Evan's case, they know where he is.
Yeah.
They just don't know right now what needs to happen to secure his release. Because I haven't seen anything that would suggest that some of the Russians have come forth and said, this is what we want. And the challenge is they'll say we're going to go through a trial, but that trial will be held behind closed doors because they're saying, well, given the charge, we can't have an open hearing. So there's no way for us to kind of even get visibility. I mean, as it is, he hasn't had a visit from consular services. We haven't, the U.S. government hasn't gotten eyes on him, which is a right afforded in any other country by now. That's a basic right that you're entitled to. And so the answer is, I don't know what the process is. I don't know because there's not that, if it's happening, I haven't seen it, that kind of discourse. And I think it's part of the stress and fear that I personally feel is I don't know. I can't, I assume there'll be a trial behind closed doors. I don't know on what basis they've held him. I don't know on what basis they would hold a case, what that case would involve. And so it's what makes me personally just so anxious about it. I was used to being anxious with Austin and still am because we don't know where he is. And that's something I've had to learn to live with. And I'm hoping that we're not in a situation where I have to try to constantly wonder what is happening. I know where he is and I still don't know. And that's what scares me. Because I'd live for 10 years thinking, okay, if I know where Austin is, we can get on the path to getting him out. And now in Evan's case, I know where he is, but I don't know the path to get him out.
Right. And what is it like, because you've been in touch with Austin's family too. I mean, what is it like for the families in a situation like this? And what do they need? Like, what is it important that they have from the news organization, from the government, in ways of support for them? Like, what is someone, like, what are Evan's parents right now in need of that those people or others can give them?
Well, one thing we've seen is a real evolution. When Austin was taken in 2012, there was no special envoy for hostage cases. And various parts of government are involved in these cases, and they often operate in silos with different interests. So the State Department's goal, for example, is maintaining diplomatic relations. The FBI, which is in charge of cases of people overseas, their interest is in holding on to evidence to eventually prosecute. The National Security Council is interested in sort of the White House policy, the U.S. administration's position at that time. And there was nobody advocating for the hostage. And often, hostage families were treated as people who couldn't be trusted. They wouldn't give them information. They wouldn't share with them. They wouldn't include them in the conversation. And then in 2014, after three Americans were killed by ISIS, and one of them learned about her son's death from a reporter because no one in the U.S. government called, there was a push to kind of create the special envoy where somebody's advocating for the family. So now we have that. I don't think from the cheap seats, I don't know if all those problems have been solved, but there's at least an understanding that the family matters. So I think if you're a family member and you've gone from a life where you're not exposed to this all the time, can you imagine you've gone from being a mother to having to manage the negotiation for the release of your child? I think they need, and they're getting it. And I think viewers and readers and listeners have been so amazing and just sort of showing their support for Evan. That's not a small thing. that's not a small thing. It's a big thing to hear that people from around the world are saying, we care. That really matters. And it's been an extraordinary thing to watch. And I think they need the reassurance from government that they'll be part of the conversation and that everybody is sort of, and it's already happening, has said, I'm willing to do what I can do to help Evan. And that's been a great thing. So I think the structural fixes in government, the overwhelmingly gracious support that we've seen, not only from journalists, but from other Americans, and the sort of that American spirit of saying, what can I do? Because yeah. I think if we work together, we can help them. And I think all those things are what need to happen and are happening. And I don't want to speak for them because I haven't spoken to them, but they need it every day until he's home. Yeah. They need all that support.
It's so important. And I mean, I remember, you know, you alluded to the hostages, the ISIS hostages who were, you know, murdered and whose deaths were filmed and put on the internet. It was at the time, I remember so vividly talking to family members who not only could not get answers out of the White House or out of the government, but who felt that the government was intentionally trying to keep them in the dark and sort of manage their loved ones' captivity as just a matter of policy. And in some cases, telling them, don't speak publicly. Mm-hmm. And this whole question of paying ransoms came up. And like some family members believing that they were even being threatened with legal action.
They were. That's right.
You know, I remember thinking to myself, you know, it was the whole process was like the humanity had just been sucked out of it, you know, like a vacuum. And it just left these people devastated and feeling entirely alone, and worse, feeling like they were being attacked by a government that was supposed to help them. And so you're so right to point out that these structural changes that they make to keep the families more in the loop, it's not just merely cosmetic. I mean, it does put forward a more empathetic face publicly, which I think the government wants, but it's absolutely crucial because every single day that goes by, these people don't know where their son is. They don't know what's happening to him. And so being just more open and honest and kind of putting the family in the front, you know, in the driver's seat with the government, I think has made a world of difference. And I think you're absolutely right that the campaign, I mean, Evan is in one way fortunate that he has other journalists who already kind of have platforms speaking out for him and, you know, writing hashtag I stand with Evan, which you all can do, by the way. But that is a major change in how we think about this. What I also think it's done, and I'm really curious what you think about this, you know, back when the ISIS hostages were taken, there was this whole question around like, well, we can't pay a ransom because it will encourage more hostage taking. And this was kind of like the frame of the debate was we can't do anything that will encourage more hostage taking. Now, kind of in the current context of Russia, post Victor Boot trade for Brittany Griner, it seems to me like, no, this is all about trading. And we've kind of crossed that threshold, if you will. I still have misgivings about it only because I'm like, God, if we now created like an incentive economy for Russia to keep kidnapping people. But it does seem to me like basically the question is, all right, what's the trade going to have to be? I mean, we haven't gotten there yet, but I just kind of assume that is the trajectory that his case is going, you know, and others of Americans who are still there. I mean, do you think that this is, that dynamic has changed too, where we just now talk openly about, all right, what's it going to take to get the person back?
Do you know I'm conflicted? Because these are all in high profile cases. Mm-hmm. You know, there have been 26 hostages who have been released during the Biden administration, 26 in 26 months, basically. How many do we know about? We know about a few of them.
Right.
And so I don't know if it's a trend or if it feels like one because it comes up in certain cases, the ones that we end up focusing on. There are so many cases I don't know about. There are cases where other groups other than the ones where I was familiar with covering are involved. But I think you're getting at the point that the way that these are resolved is evolving and has to evolve. And I would just say, I think they're different per person. It's one of the challenges with hostage cases. What worked for one person, even in the same country, might not work for the next person. Every circumstance is different. And it requires a level of creativity, I think, in terms of securing a solution. That every case I've covered, even when they look seemingly similar, have so many differences and nuances to them that make resolving them uniquely challenging. Mm-hmm. So I take your point, like, and I think it's an interesting conversation that worth having. I just wonder if that's the totality of what we're seeing, or what happened with those other, I don't know, 20 cases that we're not as familiar with, but there was a solution.
Yeah. Well, one thing that I think will be consistent in, you know, is as dangerous as this work is, journalists keep doing it, right? I mean, there will still be reporters who will go into Russia.
I'm so glad you said that, because I think people think, like, when we talk about Evan, this is about the plight of journalists, or why are people going there? This is about everybody who believes that information should be flowing, that you have a right to see what's happening, that your understanding of the world, that the ability to make the right decisions hinges on the ability of reporters to operate. This is not about journalism per se. This Evan's story is not about, well, this is a journalist issue. It is not. It is freedom of the press, mm-hmm. not only for us, but in our understanding of the world. And that if we capitulate, I would argue, to sort of state-owned media and sort of say, you know what, that's okay. Well, we don't need journalists there because they're state-owned. We're losing the opportunity to understand critical issues. And by the way, that's part of the, I mean, you know, I have a little ongoing battle with the Pentagon every day. And it's for that same reason. I'm constantly fighting for information because I believe the public, I believe in my whole of hearts that my responsibility is to fight for information because the public has a right to know. I mean, my favorite thing about working for the Wall Street Journal is how much respect it shows for the reader. I think so many news outlets will sort of push an opinion on the reader. This is how you should think about it. And we just don't have that option.
Yeah.
As you can sense, although I'm not supposed to have an opinion, there's a ticker tape of opinions running past.
You might have a few.
Just a few. All the time about everything. But when I write a story, I am saying to the reader, my job is to present it to you and let you decide. Right. And that can only happen if, and behind the scenes, we are all pushing for that information to be available to you.
Yeah.
And so, yes, they are going to keep reporting. Yeah. And it's essential that they do.
Absolutely.
We're talking about war. We're talking about a war that the United States has described between autocracy and democracy. We need to know as much about that as possible.
I want to, in the few minutes we have left, actually, and I did not tell you I was going to ask you about this, but there's a lot of information flow from the Pentagon in the past few days, which you and I are both paying a lot of attention to. This extraordinary, like, you're just like shaking your head, this extraordinary leak of classified intelligence documents from we still don't really know where. What's your take on this? And like, what are you, I mean, you're inside that building a lot and know the leadership of that building very well. And a lot of these documents were marked for what looked to be like briefings for leadership.
Yeah.
And they were not. So like, I mean, what is your thinking on the Pentagon leak story? We're now in day six of or whatever.
So dear listeners, get ready. Cause in those 6 days I have gone from, this was inadvertent, maybe somebody left him and then they got into the wrong hands, to this was intentional, to maybe it was wrong hands. Like, I keep going back and forth about how it happened in terms of intent. Obviously there was some malintent because they were published. But you notice that the documents, they're all folded.
Yes.
Like somebody put them in their pocket.
Mm.
And I thought maybe somebody left a thumb drive, because like I have a source who just keeps saying the Churchill quote, please stop assigning malfeasance to what is just ineptitude. And I'm like, and I can believe ineptitude all the time, right? Yeah. I can buy that argument, except here, I just can't quite get there.
It looks intentional because they're
full. It looks intentional. And I just don't know the degree of it. I will say this is a war that, as you noted, was supposed to be a few weeks and was not. And it has created a massive effort. And with that comes massive amounts of information flowing every single day, going into hands that didn't think they were going to be a part of this conflict at all. And so I think that you could argue that this was an environment that was more vulnerable to this kind of leak. Mm. But to the conversation we're having earlier, and this is pure speculation, I wonder if how much the lack of transparency has contributed. I'm just curious down the road if we'll discover that that was a factor, if this in fact turns out to be an intentional leak. Because the documents are interesting to me. Some of them contradict what the U.S. said its policy was or how it was approaching things. And we've seen in past leaks, often when it's intentional and done so aggressively, it's because people feel like information isn't getting out.
Right.
And so when we talk about transparency, it's not, there are consequences potentially for not sharing information to the public, the information that they have a right to know in an honest way. And in the back of my head, I don't, this is all to say, I don't know. And again, I go back and forth, but a little part of me wonders, are we going to discover there's a connection between the lack of information that we've been getting throughout the war and this leak? That's just sort of the, I
know. Somebody who wanted it out so that people understood more about what was happening.
Yeah. I have no reason. I have no basis for that, but just having covered WikiLeaks and seeing that there's the Pentagon has not been as willing as it was in past conflicts to share information. I mean, even on this, they said they're launching an investigation. They won't tell you who's doing the investigation. We knew who was doing that for WikiLeaks. Who had the documents, quote, a variety of people. I think the public is entitled to more information than that.
And it seems like this has really rattled the Pentagon too at the Joint Chiefs level.
Of course. Can you imagine? We're talking about a scenario where there is a mole who went through a month-long extensive background check to then be betraying their country. That's the worst. It's the worst case scenario.
They must be like looking over their shoulders to some degree.
Of course.
And it, presumably, like, you know, obviously there's an investigation going on to it now too, but like people probably playing a guessing game is who could it be based on who would have access to information.
That's right. Like that. Who had access? Who printed it? Because there's a system that checks it. Was it printed? Or did someone like put it on a flash drive and then take it somewhere else to be printed?
Right.
How did it end up from this website to that website? How was it able to stay online for days and days and days before anybody in the US government knew? How much more is out there potentially? Are we going to have a steady stream of this? And how does it affect relationships going forward? You know, remember in the run-up to the war, there was all this, I don't know if we can share information with the Ukrainians, the U.S. was saying, because we don't want information to get out. And look what's happened. Look what's happened. How do you share information? How do you, especially when you're not 100% sure about the ability of a nation to secure them? I don't think this just affects the war in Ukraine. I think it'll affect, because there are a lot of countries that are touched in that leak.
Yeah.
How does that affect relations going forward?
Absolutely. Well, you're going to get going, but before you do, it is our tradition on Chatter that the last question is I reach into the Chatter box and ask you a pre-selected question at random. So here you go.
I'm ready. As ready as I'll ever be.
Your question is, if you could go back in time, what piece of advice would you give to your 20-year-old self?
Have faith that it's going to work out exactly the way it's supposed to.
And you feel like it did for you, yeah?
I think personally and professionally, I feel really, I never dreamed of any of this. And I feel so, so lucky. It's such an honor to do this job.
Yeah.
It's such a responsibility. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm a crazy most days and tired and exhausted. And my child said to me yesterday, she'll never want to be a journalist. I was like, okay, well, good. Then I've done something here.
Exactly.
Don't get me wrong. It's really hard and demanding, but my goodness, to be in the first row watching history unfold and get paid for it is amazing.
Yeah. I love that you have that perspective because, you know, you and I have known each other a long time and we've both been through ups and downs and moments of like real happiness and great uncertainty. But for you, I mean, everything has worked out so beautifully. Like you're a fantastic reporter. You work in a great place. You have a beautiful family. And like all these things that I know from knowing you that are important to you and that you've wanted, like you have them. And I love that you never take them for granted. You're one of the most grateful people I know.
Well, thank you. And I feel so, so lucky. I mean, I got married later than most and all of that. And I just wish someone had told me it's going to work out.
Yeah.
Because you got to... I always tell my husband, I should have enjoyed that freedom more, man. What?
Before I shimmy your ass.
I didn't enjoy it. I was all anxious the whole time. Little did I know.
Right, right. It's good advice. I love it. Well, Nancy Youssef, this has been so much fun. Thank you for spending time on a busy time. And thank you for being on here and giving some voice to Evan and what it's like for him, and for a reminder for a lot of other people who are not home with their loved ones to keep them in our thoughts and keep pushing for them. That support means all the world.
Thank you. I really love the conversation. I love seeing you.
I love seeing you too.
I love being interviewed by you because I feel like I've learned.
Thank you. You're the best.
That was Chatter, a production of Lawfare and Goat Rodeo. Please subscribe to the podcast and find us on Twitter at That Was Chatter.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stephens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.